Charlie Wilson's War by George Crile. Continued. Disc 2. Chapter 21. Man of Destiny. When Mike Vickers arrived at the door of the South Asia Operations Group for his first interview, he was a GS-11, the civil service equivalent of a captain in the Army. At 31, with just a year and a half in the agency, he was so low in the pecking order that had he joined the 90-man Contra Task Force, he would have been one of its most junior officers. It wasn't exactly easy to find Avrakatos on the sixth floor. Every other office in the Near East Division, the mother hen of the South Asian Enterprise, had a sign next to its door, N.E. Support, N.E. Finance. Vickers had only a number to go by, 6C18. So he searched for a white door in a white hallway with no markings, just numbers in very small print next to the entrance. The idea behind this studied anonymity was to discourage those without a need to know from dropping by. Anyone could enter, however, and once inside, the unsuspecting visitor was confronted by a huge Soviet soldier in the combat uniform of a chemical warfare specialist. The uniform was the real thing, stripped off a Red Army trooper killed in Afghanistan. There was a bullet hole in the chest alongside the hammer and sickle insignia, and with its rubber gloves and gas mask, the looming figure had a Darth Vader quality about it. Such was the Dirty Dozen's innovative approach to security. They didn't like the rigmarole of locking and unlocking the door each time they came and went, so they deployed this Soviet scarecrow as their first line of defense. The threat was not some Soviet mole, but the Office of Security, which was sure to send an agent incognito one day to try to penetrate the vault to prove the branch wasn't protecting its secrets. Gust had prepared for such an incursion by installing a secretary next to the Russian soldier with instructions to deny entry to suspected security sleuths. The secretary was expecting Vickers, however, and escorted him past the burn bags into Avrakatos's suite. It, too, was part of the vaulted area, but the Office of Security had insisted on sealing it off with special doors equipped with cipher locks and peepholes. Avrakatos hadn't protested. One of his ironclad rules was never to cross the security people. He got around them by just keeping the doors open. Other officers loved to wrap their daily routine in the spookery of need to know. The ritual of closing their doors made everyone believe that important clandestine business was being transacted. But Avrakatos hated that game. Anyone who made the mistake of closing the door to his office would find themselves staring at what was probably the only pitch-black door in the agency. Avrakatos had a thing about black. He always wore it when he went on challenging operations, particularly when he wanted to intimidate someone. That was the idea behind the door, and he took a perverse enjoyment out of watching the reactions. To those few who dared ask, he would explain that he hated to be closed in and wanted people who did that to him to know that there better be a good cause. But Vickers was not the sort to needlessly close a door, nor was he intimidated by anyone. The face of the CIA is often disappointingly bland, and with his glasses and quiet demeanor, Vickers was a particularly bland-looking fellow. He had the manner of an eager but young stockbroker who had perhaps attended a good college. He just didn't look like a candidate to take over the design of the largest CIA operation in history. Avrakatos, however, had never gone about staffing his units conventionally. For starters, he didn't trust the agency to pick candidates for him. He began his recruiting drives by tapping into his informal network, the secretaries of the clandestine services. As far as he was concerned, they were the only ones who could be counted on to tell him who was good and who was a loser. "They overhear their boss's conversations," explains Avrakatos. "They know about jealousies. They know if a guy gets 35 calls a day from his wife." More than anyone in the agency, the secretaries in operations were the ones privy to the real dirt. Over his 20 years roaming the world and checking in at the agency's stations wherever he went, Avrakatos had built up a virtual network of these women. By 1984, he figured he knew 90% of the secretaries in the operations directorate, certainly all of the 25 or 30 in the Near East. He cultivated them almost as an agent network, treating them as equals and taking them to lunch even after he descended to McGaffin's job. He knew how hard it was for them to come back to headquarters, trying to live on $18,000 or $19,000 a year. Overseas, in Dhaka or Tegucigalpa, they had housing allowances, and when the dollar was strong, they could live lavishly. At Langley, they were so poor they had to cluster together in tiny houses or apartments to make ends meet. Gust always made sure they got as much overtime and as many cash bonuses as he could justify, and more than once he proved that he was willing to fight for them. One time, when his personal secretary was slated for an overseas assignment, the area chief responsible for the country where she was to be posted blackballed her, declaring that she was a Jezebel. Her crime was having been caught in an affair with a married case officer, who, of course, suffered no consequences. Avrakatos immediately rallied to the defense of his humiliated secretary, a pretty blonde divorcee. When Gust confronted the branch chief, demanding an explanation, the man made the mistake of telling him that his secretary was a fornicator, who might disrupt the station if he gave her the assignment. "Well, if that's the case, then you're going to have to fire your own secretary and one of your agents as well." "Why?" "Because I fucked them both. They're both fornicators." Back in his office, Gust summoned his secretary and the case officer with whom she was consorting. "It's all cleared up. You can have the job if you want it," he said. "But if I were you, I'd probably tell them to go to hell." He added, "I'm sorry, but you're going to have to call off the affair." Such stories make the rounds, and the secretaries knew they had a friend in Gust Avrakatos. Had it not been for them, Gust wouldn't even have considered hiring the man who would quickly become indispensable to him. The secretaries said he was special, the best writer in the branch, a near genius, and the target of jealousy in the paramilitary branch, which hadn't even passed his name on as a candidate for the job. The CIA's paramilitary unit, officially known as the Special Operations Group, was still in the process of rebuilding after years of firings and retrenchment. It had once been a major component of the CIA, a full division with land, air, and sea branches. When the agency took on Castro at the Bay of Pigs, it was two cowboy PM officers who had led the Cubans ashore and fired the first shots. PM officers had been at the heart of the successful overthrow of the Arbenz government in Guatemala in 1954. Close to 100 of them had run a massive air support operation in Laos in the late 1960s. They had always been a critical component of every major covert operation involving force, because the general case officers rarely had such expertise. Avrakatos instinctively liked these men, most of whom had begun their government service in the military. "Most of them never would have survived in the regular military," he explains with admiration. "They're the kind who like to tell generals to go fuck themselves. They don't like to shine their shoes. Some were pilots for Air America and were crazy, but that's what you want on your side. They talk straight and tell you what they believe. They hate bureaucracy. They get in trouble, drink too much, probably beat up a lieutenant colonel in a bar. So then they decide to get out of the army and go to where the action is, and that's the CIA.